Chapter 20. Appendix, a paper on administrative areas, read before the Fabian Society, footnote. I amended it to Mr. ERP's for some valuable corrections. H. G. W. Right bracket, let me begin this paper upon the question of scientific administrative areas in relation to municipal undertakings, by defining the sort of socialism I profess. Because, you know, it is quite impossible to conceal that there are very many different sorts of socialism, and your society is, and has long been, a remarkably representative collection of the various types. We have this much in common, however, that we insist upon and hammer home, and never lose sight of the fact, that property is a purely provisional, and law-made thing, and that the law and the community which has given may also, at its necessity, take away. The work which the socialist movement has done, is to secure the general repudiation of any idea of sacredness about property. But upon the extent to which it is convenient to sanction a certain amount of property, and the ways in which existing excesses of property are to be reduced, socialists differ enormously. There are certain extreme expressions of socialism that you will connect with the names of Owen and Fourier, and with Noyes' History of American Socialism, in which the abolition of monopoly is carried out with logical completeness to the abolition of marriage, and in which the idea seems to be to extend the limits of the family and of intimate intercourse to include all humanity. With these socialisms I have nothing in common. There are a large number of such questions concerning the constitution of the family upon which I retain an open and inquiring mind, and to which I find the answers of the established order, if not always absolutely incorrect, at any rate glaringly incomplete and totally inadequate. But I do not find the answers of these socialistic communities in any degree more satisfactory. There are, however, more limited socialisms, systems which deal mainly with economic organizations, which recognize the rights of individuals to possessions of a personal sort, and which assume without detailed discussion the formation of family groups within the general community. There are limited socialisms whose repudiation of property affects only the common interests of the community, the land it occupies, the services in which all are interested, the necessary minimum of education, and the sanitary and economic interaction of one person or family group upon another. Socialisms which, in fact, come into touch with an intelligent individualism, and which are based on the attempt to ensure equality of opportunity and freedom for complete individual development to every citizen. Such socialists look not so much to the abolition of property as to the abolition of inheritance, and to the intelligent taxation of property for the services of the community. It is among such moderate socialists that I would number myself. I would make no hard and fast rule with regard to any portion of the material and apparatus used in the service of a community. With regard to any particular service or concern, I would ask, is it more convenient, more likely to lead to economy and efficiency, to let this service rest in the hands of some single person or group of persons who may offer to do the service or administer the concern, and whom we will call the owners, or to place it in the hands of some single person or group of persons, elected or chosen by lot, whom we will call the official or group of officials? And if you were to suggest some method of election that would produce officials that, on the whole, were likely to manage worse than private owners, and to waste more than the private owners' probable profits, I should say then by all means, leave the service or concern in private hands. You see, upon this principle the whole question of the administration of any affair turns upon the question, which will give the maximum efficiency. It is very easy to say, and it stirs the heart and produces cheering in crowded meetings to say, let everything be owned by all, and controlled by all for the good of all, and for the general purposes of a meeting it is quite possible to say that and nothing more. But if you sit down quietly by yourself afterwards, and try and imagine things being led by all, and controlled by all for the good of all, you will presently arrive at the valuable discovery in social and political science, that the phrase means nothing whatever. It is also very striking, on such rhetorical occasions, to oppose the private owner to the community, or the state or the municipality, and to suppose all the vices of humanity concentrated in private ownership, and all the virtues of humanity concentrated in the community. But indeed that clear and striking contrast will not stand the rough and tumble of the workaday world. A little examination of the matter will make it clear that the contrast lies between private owners and public officials. You must have officials, because you can't settle a railway timetable or make a bridge by public acclamation, and even there you will find it is not a simple question of the white against black order. Even in our state today there are few private owners who have absolute freedom to do what they like with their possessions, and there are few public officials who have not a certain freedom and a certain sense of proprietorship in their departments, and in fact, as distinguished from rhetoric, there is every possible gradation between the one thing and the other. We have to clear our minds of misleading terms in this affair. A clipped and regulated private ownership, a private company, for example, with completely published accounts, tax dividends, with a public representative upon its board of directors and parliamentary powers, may be an infinitely more honest, efficient, and controllable public service than a badly elected or badly appointed board of governors of officials. We may, and I for one do think, that a number of public services, an increasing number of public services, can be best administered as public concerns. Most of us here tonight are, I believe, pretty advanced municipalizers. But it does not follow that we believe that any sort of representative or official body pitched into any sort of area is necessarily better than any sort of private control. The more we are disposed to municipalize, the more incumbent it is upon us to search out, study, and invent, and to work to develop the most efficient public bodies possible. And my case tonight is that the existing local government bodies, your town councils, borough councils, urban district boards, and so forth, are, for the purposes of municipalization, far from being the best possible bodies, and that even your county councils fall short, that by their very nature all these bodies must fall far short of the highest possible efficiency, and that as time goes on they must fail even more than they do now to discharge the duties we Fabians would like to thrust upon them. And the general reason upon which I would have you condemn these bodies, and seek for some newer and ampler ones before you press the municipalization of public concerns to its final trial, is this: that their areas of activity are impossibly small. The areas within which we shape our public activities at present derive, I hold, from the needs and conditions of a past order of things. They have been patched and repaired enormously, but they still preserve the essential conceptions of a vanished organization. They have been patched and repaired first to meet this urgent specific necessity and then that, and never with any comprehensive anticipation of coming needs, and at last they have become absolutely impossible. They are like 15th century houses which have been continuously occupied by a succession of enterprising, but short-sighted and close-fisted owners, and which have now been, with the very slightest use of lath and plaster partitions and geyser hot water apparatus, converted into modern residential flats. These local government areas of today represent for the most part what were once distinct, distinctly organized, and individualized communities, complete minor economic systems, and they preserve a tradition of what was once administrative convenience and economy. Today, I submit, they do not represent communities at all, and they become more wasteful and more inconvenient with every fresh change in economic necessity. This is a double change. Let me first of all say a word in justification for my first assertion, that existing areas do not represent communities, and then pass to a necessary consequence or so of this fact. I submit that before the railways, that is to say in the days in which the current conception of local government areas arose, the villages, and still more the boroughs, and even the counties, were practically complete minor economic systems. The wealth of the locality was, roughly speaking, local. Rich people resided in contact with their property, other people lived in contact with their work, and it was a legitimate assumption that a radius of a mile or so, or of a few miles, circumscribed most of the practical interests of all the inhabitants of a locality. You got rich and poor invisible relationships. You got landlord and tenant, you got master and workman all together. But now, through a revolution in the methods of locomotion, and chiefly through the making of railways, this is no longer true. You can still see the villages and towns separated by spaces of fields and physically distinct, but it is no longer the case that all who dwell in these old limits are essentially local inhabitants, and mutually interdependent as once they would have been. A large proportion of our population today, a large and an increasing proportion, has no localized interests at all as an 18th century person would have understood locality. Take for example Guildford, or Folkestone, and you will find that possibly even more than half the wealth in the place is non-local wealth, wealth, that is, having no relation to the local production of wealth, and that a large majority of the more educated, intelligent and active inhabitants derive their income, spend their energies, and find their absorbing interests outside the locality. They may rent their own houses, but they have no reality of participation, and little illusion of participation in any local life. You will find in both towns a considerable number of hotels, inns, and refreshment places which, although they are regulated by local magistrates upon a basis of one license to so many inhabitants, derive only a small fraction of their profits from the custom of the inhabitants. You find too in Folkestone, as in most seaside places, a great number of secondary schools, drawing scarcely a pupil from the neighborhood. And on the other hand, you will find labor in both towns, coming in by a morning train and going out at night. And neither of these instances is an extreme type. As you come in towards London, you will find the proportion of what I would call non-local inhabitants increasing until in Brixton, Hoxton, or West Ham you will find the really localized people a mere thread in the mass of the population. Probably you find the thinnest sham of a community in the London boroughs, where a clerk or a working man will shift his sticks from one borough to another, and move on to a third without ever discovering what he has done. It is not that all these people do not belong to a community, but that they belong to a larger community of a new type which your administrators have failed to discover, and which your working theory of local government ignores. This is a question I have already written about with some completeness in a book published a year or so ago, and called Dissipations, and in that book you will find a more lengthy exposition than I can give here, and now of the nature of this expansion. But the gist of the argument is that the distribution of population, the method of aggregation in a community, is determined almost entirely by the available means of locomotion. The maximum size of any community of regular daily intercourse is determined by the length of something that I may best suggest to your mind by the phrase the average possible suburban journey in an hour. A town, for example, in which the only method of progression is on foot along crowded ways, will be denser in population and smaller in area than one with wide streets and a wheeled traffic, and that again will be denser and compacter than one with numerous tubes, trams, and light railways. Every improvement in locomotion forces the suburban ring of houses outward and relieves the pressure of the center. Now, this principle of expanding communities holds not only in regard to towns, but also on the agricultural countryside. There, also, facilities for the more rapid collection of produce mean finally the expansion and coalescence of what were previously economic unities. Now if, while this expansion of the real communities goes on, you keep to the old boundary lines, you will find an increasing proportion of your population straddling those lines. You will find that many people who once slept and worked, and reared their children, and worshipped and bought all in one area, are now, as it were, delocalized. They have overflowed their containing locality, and they live in one area, they work in another, and they go to shop in a third. And the only way in which you can localize them again is to expand your areas to their new scale. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.